Creepy right-wingers. Apparently something I said the other night about the SEAL team visiting George W. Bush when they finished up with Bin Laden struck a chord with these freaks. Indeed it did. Somebody emailed me and said, guess what? You're on the front page of the Drudge Report. Woo! That's like walking through the sewer, right? But apparently, I don't know because I have a logarithm that tosses a lot of these emails out, but apparently there was a spate. Look it up, right-wingers. A spate of slime headed this way today from right-wing emails. And what is intriguing about it to me, a couple got through because they didn't have the F word in them or the P word or the C word or the, you know, typical right-wing white male or female Christian emailers. But the few that got through, it's amazing to me, not really, how right-wingers in this country will support, without question, a mass killer, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, somebody who would, with no provocation whatsoever, invade a country, Iraq, slaughter its inhabitants, including other Christians, Jews, a few, I guess, and Muslims, just butcher them, incinerate them. And then had the temerity to write me an email suggesting there's something wrong with my brain functions, if I have any, according to some of these half-wits, for suggesting that once the SEAL team captured one mass killer, if he in fact is guilty as charged, they ought to go after some other ones, like George Bush and Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Henry Kissinger. We have a bunch of them right here. I can provide the addresses. But to understand fully, Truth Seeker, how sick and just their brains completely blown out right-wingers are in this country, Republicans, neocons, whatever you want to call these pigs, they will defend a mass killer like Bush. And if you suggest to them that George W. Bush had no provocation whatsoever to murder a million people, up to a million people in Iraq. None whatsoever, except he wanted to show that his was bigger than his daddy's, which was the only reason he did it. Oh, the oil, but, you know, it's more important to get over the Oedipal thing. You know what I'm saying? Look it up. Look it up, right-winger. You know how to spell it? Eh, oh well. So anyway, to the right wingers who very carefully typed on their keyboards, and what amazes me, I get emails from people whose SIG lines include the name of their businesses, their companies, and these dumb bastards can't even spell. When they say your attitude, they spell it YOU'RE. Anyway, thanks to the, thanks to the right-wing websites and blog sites who publicize this program. By the way, you guys don't have to run such an ugly picture. I mean, everybody takes ugly pictures, but Jesus Christ. I mean, I've got some good ones out there if you just look around. Just amazing. Just amazing. This hour is sponsored by Claudia. Can I say her last name? Claudia Seifer. No message, just a sponsorship from Claudia. Thank you, Claudia. That's very kind. I will be off tomorrow night. I'm going to go to a graduation ceremony, we will be playing a best of. So tonight we are giving away two, count them, two $50 gift certificates from Pro Flowers. So at the bottom of this hour, which is in about 20 minutes, and the bottom of the next hour, we will give away, like we have been doing, no big deal, just like the seventh caller, the ninth caller, whatever. And I think it's a hell of a giveaway from Pro Flowers. Because, as you know, you've been hearing the commercials on this program that I recorded. You know, for $29, you can get just an excellent gift. These and this is a $50 gift certificate, and it's good until the end of this year. So if you don't use it for Mother's Day or Father's Day or whatever day is coming up, you can use it at Christmas or somebody's birthday. All right? Okay. Bush declines Obama's invitation to join him at Ground Zero in New York City tomorrow to mark the killing of Osama bin Laden. Bush's spokesman, David Scherzer, said, quote, President Bush will not be in attendance on Thursday. He appreciated the invite, but has chosen in his post-presidency to remain largely out of the spotlight. He continues to celebrate with Americans this important victory in the war on terror, end quote. Actually, the reason George W. Bush decided not to go is because the horror that occurred in Lower Manhattan on September 11, 2001 is a testimonial and a monument that will last as long as there is recorded history. A testimonial and a monument to the utter incompetence of his and Dick Cheney's administration. That he, George W. Bush, and his puppet master, Dick Cheney, allowed the single largest act of terror to occur on this continent, or this country, since the War of 1812. It is a day of shame and infamy for George W. Bush and his entire administration. How many times did these rat bastard neocon Republicans assure us that their duty was to protect the American people? Which it is not. It is to protect and defend the Constitution. But George, for Christ's sake, that doesn't mean just sit back on your ass and allow 3,000 people to be murdered in Midtown Lower Manhattan. No wonder you don't want to go there. I wouldn't if I were you either, George. Shame on you. I can't believe, well, there's Barack Obama again with that, you know, that reach around, you know, hey, come on down with me, Mr. Unindicted War Criminal. Let's go down and stand on this ground, the ground that you allowed to be saturated in destruction because you and your national security team paid no attention to warning after warning, even when they wrote it out and put it in your goddamn hands. You still refuse to do anything. So no, George, don't go there. In a certain way, a certain manner of speaking, that's hallowed ground on some basis, but none that you're privy to. Stay away, George. Stay away. Don't go. Don't. And bless you, Mr. Bush, for refusing. I don't care what the reason is. When you look in the mirror in the morning to shave, you know what the reason is, don't you, Mr. Bush? Because you allowed it. You did not protect the country. You ignored every single warning. You and that creepy Dick Cheney. Oy. The White House did not confirm that the invitation had been made. Nor did it comment on Mr. Bush's decision. Well, that's very diplomatic. George W. Bush going to Lower Manhattan. I wonder if they had planned on giving him a bullhorn again. We'll be right back.
on the first. That's why I'm spitting cyanide each and every verse. I see the Carlisle Group and Harris bank accounts. I see them plead the fifth each and every session now. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is make an enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt. And take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Oil, blood, money make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you...
It's More Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. And again, this hour is sponsored by Claudia Seifer. Thanks, Claudia. No message, just sponsorship. Thanks, Claudia. We appreciate it very much. This is, I don't know, you know, karma can be a very profound, or can create a very profound circumstance. And it's a shame when karma uses a child, but a 10-year-old boy has been charged with murder in juvenile court in... Where is it, California? Riverside, California? Is it California? I think it is. This comes through the Daily Mail in the UK. The 10-year-old sat in the courtroom in an orange juvenile hall uniform and shackled. 10-year-old. He listened silently as a charge of murder. And another charge of using a gun in the commission of the killing was read out. Authorities claim that the boy, who has not been identified, intentionally shot 32-year-old Jeff Hall, his father, at the Riverside home on Sunday. Jeff Hall was a regional director for the National Socialist Movement, Nazis, American Nazis. He was killed at his home in the early hours of Sunday morning. Authorities are not commenting. The deputy district attorney, Ambrosio Rodriguez, said the circumstances of the case, including having a suspect of such a young age, are extremely rare. If he is found guilty, the charged boy could remain in juvenile hall until he's 18 or another youth detention facility until he's 25. His father was regional leader of the National Socialist Movement, which promotes Nazism and white separatism and anti-Semitism and just about every other sick, demented philosophy you can come up with. His other four children have been taken into protective custody. What do you want to bet that he beats his wife, too? Well, beat his wife. He's dead now. Neighbors said that the dead father held a Halloween party at his house last year, and people showed up in Klan outfits and Nazi regalia. The boy's public defender said the defense was weighing several possible pleas, including not guilty by reason of insanity. His stepmother, the boy's stepmother, mother and grandmother were present at the hearing. As he left the courtroom, the 10-year-old waved a shackled hand to them, causing his mother to break down. The father, the dead father, was a plumber and rising star in the neo-Nazi group that is based in Detroit. And he ran for office once. He wanted to be on his local water board. I'm not making that up. Water board. Neighbors said he flew swastikas from his home. Yada, yada, yada. A New York Times reporter attended a meeting of the local group at his home the night before he was killed, where the dead dad called on members to join him for militia-style raids on immigrants along the Mexican-Arizona border. He said, according to Times reporter, quote, "This is a very active area right now. You guys get your Glocks cocked and get ready to rock. We're going to the border. That's how we do it. End quote. Well, not, you don't do it now, do you, pal? Huh? By the way, what's the temperature in hell? According to the coroner's office, Mr. Hall died of a single gunshot wound. Blah, blah, blah. 10-year-old boy. Instruments of karma. It's just amazing how the laws of physics work. Action, reaction. No, nothing religious about it. I mean, the Christians might find something religious about it, or the Muslims, or the Jews, or the Hindus, or somebody. But no, it's just a simple governing principle of the universe. Action, reaction. I guess sometimes it is a good idea to have a loaded weapon in your house. I feel sorry for the boy. I wonder, I wonder what his family life was like. I wonder how many beatings he saw his mother take. I wonder how much violence until finally a 10-year-old snaps. Or somebody wanted to tell me, oh, it was an accident. Really? Maybe it was. Maybe it was. Although I just find that a little hard to accept. All right. We have a break coming here, so... When we come back after this break, we'll clear the lines. I'll let you know, and we're going to give away a $50 gift card from ProFlowers. Stick around. We'll be right back.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
...25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Claudia Seifer. Thanks, Claudia. Okay, here's what we'll do. Kathy will open up the lines, and the number here is 877-996-2556. 877-996-2556. If you are the fifth caller. A $50 Pro Flowers gift card will be mailed to you. Kathy will get the information. And we'll do it again next hour, too. It's a pretty good deal, I think. I mean, it's a wonderful deal. It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to do anything. No trivia contest. All right. R.B. Ham in Canada writes, regarding Bush going to Lower Manhattan to commemorate the people who died there and to acknowledge the death of Osama bin Laden. R.B. writes, it would be bad form for a Bush to show up and celebrate the death of a family member of their loyal business partners. As you know, the links between the bin Laden construction empire and the Bush crime family are well known. I'll bet the farm that there was a call from the Saudi king to Bush Sr. I'll bet there was, too. Yeah, the bin Laden family, and I guess this is what these brain-dead morons who read the Drudge Report, dear God, who would go there? But I guess this is something they don't understand. They have no working knowledge of U.S. history or, I mean, contemporary history, if that's not a contradiction in terms. They have no idea that the Bush and the bin Ladens, they have no idea that when there was a no-fly order put in this country for, well, 3 or 4 days after the attack on September 11, 2001, that there were two massive, what were they, 747s at the time, huge jets that flew around the country to scoop up members of the Saudi royal family, members of the bin Laden family, on the orders of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and take them back to Saudi Arabia. You dumb bastards, you know nothing, do you? And you have the audacity to write to me? Because I point, you stuff your face in a dead skunk, and that is the attitude of George W. Bush? Oh, we don't care about him. We don't know where he is. He's in a cave, hides out. I don't care. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Get out of town, you thugs. God. Barack Obama says he will not release the photos of bin Laden's corpse. He said he was persuaded by Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that the release of the images would pose a national security risk. Really? Is that right? Was there a security risk when Donald Rumsfeld showed the pictures of the corpses, the brutal photos of the dead bodies of Saddam Hussein's son, Qusay and Usay and Dusay, whatever the hell their names were? I don't remember that. According to White House spokesperson Jay Carney, the press secretary, on an interview to be broadcast this Sunday on 60 Minutes, Obama said, "There's no doubt that we killed Osama bin Laden. We don't need to spike the football by showing the pictures." I've got mixed feelings about it. There are those, most of them are right-wingers, they're Republicans, they're Bush lovers, who are into torture porn. You know, just like when word got out that Cheney had insisted that DVDs of the tortures in Guantanamo be made and sent to him. And you can just see these voracious bastards sitting around in some undisclosed location watching the torture videos or the torture discs. We know that happened. I mean, we know that happened. So Cheney and Bush lovers are, by extension, eaters of torture porn. They love it. So the right-wingers would love to see these photos. There is that aspect. But then there's another aspect, okay? And the other aspect, Irish Dave writes, "Mike, how is it that Americans are shielded from seeing the results of our so-called freedom crusade? It's civilized to invade, torture, kill, and assassinate, but not civilized to show the photos?" I suspect that Colonel Jessup was right. Irish Dave. Colonel Jessup, you know. The truth! You can't handle the truth! That Colonel Jessup. I don't need to see any more photographs of corpses or mutilated bodies. You know, I really don't. I mean, I think the right-wingers in this country need to see it because it is their substitute for normal sexual activity. Come on, you know I'm right. You know I'm right. Oh, my God. So anyway, an executive decision was made. I think it's kind of ridiculous. You know the photos are going to get out at some point. And because that's, I mean, people who make a living, is that phrase I'm looking for? Selling photos like this or getting them to various media outlets. It seems that in Europe or other parts, the Middle East maybe, photos of brutally murdered people, children who have had their legs blown off, or their eyes eaten out by white phosphorus that we happen to drop on them, that those kinds of photos in other parts of the world are seen as a consequence of what people in a lot of the world live with on a daily basis. Murder, mayhem, death, destruction. a lot of which is brought to them courtesy of either the United States directly or indirectly in the way we support and arm brutal terror administrations until we're ready to get rid of them. So to think that there are 338 million Americans who, with their tax money, support this kind of stuff, and with their votes put into office people who, where it regards George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, allow this country to be attacked and all the death to occur here, and then retaliate by invading a country that had nothing to do with it and killing a million people there. I mean, that's the kind of goddamn insanity that we live with today. So, and on the other hand, President Obama, who, I don't know. This country has been pursuing Osama bin Laden for a decade, longer, since back in 96, I think. Isn't that what the right-wing termites and cockroaches in this country insist, that Bill Clinton had a chance to murder him and didn't take it? They don't mention Tora Bora. They don't mention George W. Bush and Dick Cheney by their inaction saying to terrorists, yeah, we're ready, come and kill us. We need it. You sick morons. So, bottom line, apparently the Obama administration, whoever makes the decisions, I guess the final decision is Barack Obama's, but according to reliable sources, you know, Gates and Clinton and probably other members of the general staff, decided that we just couldn't handle it. Now the tack they take, or the point that they make as well, it'll be used for propaganda, or it'll be inflammatory to our enemies. I don't think our enemies can be more inflamed than they already are. I mean, we've had a decade of murdering Iraqis and Afghans and Pakistanis, and I mean, just go down the list. We have plans of murdering many, many more instead of just picking up our military and whatever equipment we need and coming the hell home. We got Osama bin Laden. What's the point? Saddam Hussein has been hanged. Osama bin Laden has been murdered. Okay. We won! USA! USA! So why not come home? The fact that we will not come home is the provocation, not some photograph that is just a little bit too intense for the delicate American public. Whereas people in the rest of the world look at that, oh, yeah, they got Osama bin Laden. Look at that, bullet right in his eye. Oh, that's interesting. What's this, another one? Oh, that one went through his chin. Jesus God, look at that. His whole bottom half of his face has been blown off. Well, you know, war is hell.
Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Claudia Seifer. Thank you, Claudia. Does it matter to you if you see Bin Laden's corpse? Does that make any difference in what your attitude will be about the failure of the Bush crime family to prevent the original attack on this country? In other words, allowing it to happen for their own sick, degenerate sets of goals, what they had planned, but they needed another Pearl Harbor. They even said that. They're cronies. So as far as the photos of this corpse is concerned, I think it's a factoid that only in this country does it become an issue. Do Americans not understand what the $750 billion a year that they donate to the security apparatus in this country that never works when it's this country that is that should be secured, but always works in the death and destruction of other countries? Are Americans not aware that that $700 billion a year is used to do what, you morons? Build schools? No, it's used to kill people. Lots of people. To smash them into red mist. And what have they done? These children and old ladies and old men and young women and teenagers. What have they done? So the idea of seeing the picture of a corpse. I'll tell you what, I'll be in favor of this. If in return, the American public can also see whatever pictures are available of just the people that have been murdered by Bush and Cheney and Obama and Clinton in the last, 12 years. How's that for a fair exchange? How many of those pictures could Americans look at? Now, Republicans would just sit there and get sexually aroused. Give me more! Give me more! That's what conservatives do. They love it because that's the justification for their sick, tortured religion. But I'll come down squarely in favor for the right-wingers of dancing the pictures of this corpse all over American media. And in return, let's show a few hundred thousand of the other ones that we have turned into chunks of dead flesh, shattered bone, eyeballs protruding on the dirt. Or maybe just the ones murdered by Blackwater. Fair trade, you right-wing freaks. God, we live in a sick society. You ever go to crikey.com? Writer there. Is it Jesus F. Crikey? Is that his name? he had something the other day. By the time Osama died, he had already died. Indeed, compared to efficient and focused terror groups like the IRA, the Irgun, November 17 in Greece, it is stunning how ineffectual al-Qaeda managed to be in the Crusader heartland when you factor in the ruthlessness they were willing to apply in their methods, a lethality far beyond any terror group yet known. Indeed, when you look for parallels for the murderousness of al-Qaeda, you have to leave behind non-state actors altogether. What makes al-Qaeda so terrifying is that it applied the levels of death and destruction that had previously only been in the hands of the state. Morally speaking, 9/11 was no worse than a B-52 run over Vietnam, for example, and far less worse than both the initial act and eventual consequences of the 1970 U.S. invasion of Cambodia. 9/11 employed a weird symmetry. What had most terrified those subjects to imperialism in the post-World War II years had been the lethal, amoral might of a territorial power. What terrified us most in the West was Al-Qaeda's territorylessness, its apparent ability to strike anywhere and to leave an image trace, the burning towers in the public archive, and the Occidental consciousness. 9/11 was singular because at its apex was a man, Mohammed Atta, who had the burning hatred of other suicide operatives, yet lacked the mental disorganization. Yet what was most remarkable about 9/11 was not its occurrence, but its rarity. Irish Dave sent it to me. But let not the American public look at the shattered face of the person we've been told for 10 years was responsible. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Jay Farner.
The Kent State shootings, also known as the May 4th Massacre, or Kent State Massacre, occurred that long ago, 41 years ago today, Kent State University in the city of Kent, Ohio. It was about the shooting of unarmed college students by members of the Ohio National Guard. The guardsmen fired 67 rounds over a period of 13 seconds, killing 4 students and wounding 9 others, one of whom suffered permanent paralysis. Some of the students who were shot had been protesting against the American invasion of Cambodia, which Richard Nixon announced in a television address 5 days earlier. Other students who were shot had been walking nearby or observing the protest from a distance. There was a significant national response to the shootings. Hundreds of universities, colleges, and high schools closed throughout the United States due to a student strike of 4 million students. And the event further affected the public opinion over the role of the United States in the Vietnam War. 4 million students. And then, of course, there was the now iconic photo of Marianne Vecchio, 14-year-old girl, kneeling in anguish over the body of Jeffrey Miller, dead minutes after he was shot by the Ohio National Guard. You remember that picture. She's down on her knees with her arms outstretched and her mouth open, screaming. Kent State, 41 years ago today. Who remembers that? 4 million students went on strike. 4 million. And what was the high school population of this country 41 years ago? Diana in Florida wrote the other night and said, Mike, my first reaction to the assassination of bin Laden was dismay, not jubilation. He should have been arrested, charged with his alleged crimes, and put on trial. Or is the information a trial would bring to the surface what the ruling elite feared? We seem to live in a James Bond fantasy land where it's okay to kill someone simply because they're unpopular with the government or the public. Where's the due process here? The rule of law is disappearing. Why are we applauding it? What if the government decides it doesn't like me, whoever me happens to be? Do we no longer teach children that the reason you protect the rights of the despised is to preserve those rights for yourself? Apparently not. My message to the young people cheering in the streets over the murder of bin Laden, you will get the government you deserve. Diana in Florida. Yeah, isn't that the truth? It's hard to, for another couple of days, I mean, we're trying to pull away from assassination or the justice provided to Osama bin Laden. This hour is sponsored by Tom Bateson, whose message, continue to reveal and tell the truth with your passion. Thanks. Well, thank you, Tom. In an attempt to try to get away from the story, the assassination, the capture, murder, execution, justice served, whatever you want to call it. Saw this today. The population of the world, which was expected by people who study this stuff, expected to stabilize just above 9 billion in the middle of this century, will instead keep growing and may hit 10.1 billion by the year 2100. Now, you're not going to be alive then. Neither am I. That's for goddamn sure. But your grandchildren might. This was in a report released yesterday by the United Nations. Growth in Africa remains so high that the population there could triple in the century, rising from today's 1 billion to 3.6 billion in Africa. That's a sobering forecast for a continent already struggling to provide food and water to the people it has. New report comes just ahead of a demographic milestone. In late October this year, the world population is expected to pass 7 billion. That's only 12 years after it passed 6 billion. I remember when I first came back to Atlanta in 1970, 72, 73, the population hit 4 billion. And when I was a kid growing up, just like when you were a kid growing up, the population of the world was a little over 2 billion. Wow, huh? A demographer at the Population Council, which is a research group in New York, said, quote, every billion more people makes life more difficult for everybody. It's as simple as that, end quote. He went on to say, is it the end of the world? No. Can we feed 10 billion people? Probably. But we obviously would be better off with a smaller population, end quote. Among the factors behind the upward revisions is that fertility is not declining as rapidly as expected in some poor countries and has shown a slight increase in many wealthier countries, including the United States, Britain, and Denmark. But there's another reason. There's another reason, and that is because, once again, these filthy, right-wing, neoconservative, religious, crazy people forced the United States, which leads in the Western world in trying to get family planning information out to populations that desperately need that information. But the crazy right wingers have defunded family planning programs because, and especially the Catholic Church is especially guilty of this. You know, their intent is to populate heaven, but to commit all sorts of atrocities and murders on earth. You know, let people suffer. Let people wallow in their own excrement. But, you know, you'll go to heaven someday if you just, you know, send your money to the Pope and don't scream when you see that the Pope's minions have been molesting your children. Just do what you're told. Do what you're told. But the crazy right wing in this country has forced several presidents to cut back on family planning because, God forbid, there might be an abortion. Oh, my goodness. Or God forbid that somebody would provide condoms, especially over there in that Africa place where, you know, all those people do is want to hump each other. Well, if they're going to hump each other, then they have to take the consequences. But see, the right-wing Christians thought the consequences were AIDS. But it's not. It's more children. Over the past decade, foreign aid to pay for contraceptives has barely budged, according to United Nations estimates. The United States has been the biggest donor, but the budget compromise in Congress last month cut international family planning programs by 5%. Oh, that makes sense. Sure, do it. Yeah. Do it. Cut all that stuff. You know, let's have billions upon billions upon billions of people on Earth. Maybe some of that Malthusian predictions will come true. Huh? Well, we need a couple of massive wars. I mean, big ones, man, that's going to wipe out billions, right? This is what the right wingers are hoping for. This is what the neocons are planning. There's no time left for you. Update here on this is not an update. This is about a week old. It's from a newspaper in Wisconsin, Isthmus, Isthmus, Isthmus. Will you try to pronounce it? Anyway, they're reporting, Jay Rath at that newspaper is reporting, under Governor Scott Walker's proposed budget, Wisconsin libraries would see their funding requests cut by more than $18.9 million in 2012 alone, threatening a wide variety of services, including those for job seekers and the blind. Wow. Cuts to Wisconsin library budgets come in three areas. State aid to school libraries would be cut by $4.6 million. Funding to the state's 17 public library systems would be cut by $13.5 million, essentially ending materials sharing. State talking book and braille services will be cut by 10%. The final impact of all this is unknown, of course. In Madison, Wisconsin, Barb Dimmick, director of the Madison Public Library, says there are library programs covering jobs, health, taxes, and financial literacy. She said, quote, "We call ourselves a learning center. We have more programs than we ever had in my tenure, and they're all going to be slashed ribbons by Governor Scott Walker." This is how it works. All this filthy puke would have to do would be to insist that corporations doing business in the state of Wisconsin, any kind of business, whether it's manufacturing within the state or selling its products within the state, that all those corporations would have to pay state corporate income tax that would go into the public coffers of the state of Wisconsin. And, of course, the committee would have to be set up, because who in the hell is going to trust this rat bastard? But a committee set up to pay down this imaginary debt. Well, it's a real debt, but it was one created by Scott Walker, and make sure that libraries stay open. But on the other hand, this is what Republicans want. This is what neocons, this is what right-wing conservatives insist on. Ignorance. They are ignorant, and they don't want anyone else to be educated. Ignorance works for them. I can show you 1,000 emails that I have kept that eventually will show up in print, along with the addresses of the writers. I can show you 1,000 emails written by semi-literate right-wingers who think they are being so slick and so smart and so cool and so with it, when in fact what they're showing is that somebody sucked out their brains and replaced it with horse excrement. And that is what they use to try to put together coherent sentences or form a coherent thought. It is pathetic. My God. All right. When we come back after this break in a couple of minutes, it's not yet, we're going to do another, don't call now. We're going to give away the second $50 gift certificate to for Pro Flowers. Also, the third hour, torture. You may not want to stick around. I wouldn't blame you if you bug out. There's a piece in Foreign Policy, at foreignpolicy.com, by Matthew Alexander about torture. The question, did torture work? And a quick answer, the United States didn't need to waterboard anyone to get Osama bin Laden. That was a result of police work, detective work. Only not by, the cops or the detectives you see on television, but by a wide network of people, including the vaunted and feared CIA, State Department, informants, people that we pay for information. But torture was not the reason we got Osama bin Laden. Torture, however, has become a theme in the American political system, especially where it concerns foreign policy. Oh, I know. It's banned. It was banned in, 2004? Is that right? Is that how long it's been since we toured? Yeah, okay, right. Okay. Got it. But Matthew Alexander's piece at foreignpolicy.com gets into this a little bit. And then the third hour tonight, I'm going to talk about it from a more direct level, not the theoretical level, not the level or the points made by an essayist like Matthew Alexander, but the voices of people in Iraq who were tortured and how they are dealing with the aftermath. Stick around. I'm Mike Molloy.
liberal helping of truth. It's More Mike Malloy.
All right. Are you ready to play? Kathy's going to open up the lines. And what's at stake here is a $50 gift card. It'll be sent to you via snail mail. $50 gift card from Pro Flowers. And it's good until December 31st of this year. You can use it for anything you like. And we will take caller number 6. The number here is 877-996-2556. Enjoy. This hour is sponsored by Tom Bateson. Tom, I hope I pronounced your name right. Bateson. He has a message. Continue to reveal and tell the truth with your passion. Thanks. Thank you, Tom. All right. Regarding the population explosion, Prairie 2 writes, that sort of population increase, especially in Africa, is not likely to be sustainable. The deeper they push into wild areas to exploit resources, the more likely they will encounter and spread a disease we can't withstand. New drug-resistant bacterial infections crop up every few years, and not just in Africa, not to mention viruses like HIV, influenza, and Ebola. If one of these turns out to be easily transmitted, it's pale horse time. Yeah, well, that's very true. Look what the Black Death did a couple of times as it swept through Europe. Well, not just Europe, it swept through most of the civilized world on various visits and was very effective in population control. Speaking of Prairie 2, let's get to his missive for today. The stock market indexes were down sharply today, and this was reported as caused by disappointing job creation numbers, but that never concerns Wall Street, so it must be something else. On the commodities markets, oil, gold, and other precious metals fell for the third straight day as Obama's poll numbers shoot up among independent voters. Perhaps the specter of regulated capitalism is sending a chill down the spines of budding feudal lords. The U.S. dollar strengthened again, even as other countries continue to diversify away from the dollar. Mexico becomes the latest country to announce that they have been buying heavily in the gold market, acquiring 100 tons in the first quarter. That much gold is worth 4.6 billion U.S. dollars, or 53 billion pesos at current prices. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's only a little more than what we give the oil companies in subsidies every year. And Sarah Palin says that's nothing, as long as you're giving it to the oil companies. Palin declares that amount to be meager compared to the $14 trillion in debt, and she points out that, quote, President Obama had at least a hand in running that up, end quote. She got surprisingly close to the truth compared to most Republicans who seem to think we had a balanced budget right up until Obama was elected. The truth is, of course, that the debt was entirely run up by Republicans. Even Obama has been largely using the George Bush budget scheme, as Obama's budget never passed, and the country has been cruising along on continuing budget resolution and Bush's tax rates. It's all Bush. The U.S. dollar is close to all-time lows, having lost 10% since January compared to other major currencies. But this is not as big of a deal as one might assume. Oil priced in euros has been going up just as fast. For example, Europe has its own problems thanks to including too many countries in the EU without keeping the smaller ones away from the Ponzi schemes of Wall Street and the London bankers. The problem in the U.S. is that unlike most developed countries, our rich people aren't industrialists or even landed gentry. They maintain their lifestyles by shuffling paper around and selling our assets to the emerging empires like China. We would be far better off here to just pay the bills of the wealthy class like Great Britain does with the Queen. Every time Donald Trump gets married, we could throw a big party and have a parade. It only costs the Brits $36 million U.S. dollars to marry off the prince, cheap compared to the $2 billion we give the oil companies. With $2 billion, we could throw 56 royal weddings a year, enough to keep the networks busy 24/7. Think of all the jobs that would create for us commoners. All of this may be moot as Intel announced today that they are going ahead with production of the biggest technological advance since the transistor was invented. I think they're being modest. This new technology will allow the production of three-dimensional computing chips. Old-fashioned, so-called, chips are designed in two dimensions, which severely limits how many transistors can directly interact to approximately just 10 to any one other transistor, no matter how small you make them, which is insignificant compared to the connectivity of neurons in a brain. This is why computers are just stupid sorting machines. And the so-called artificial intelligence portrayed by chess-playing machines and Jeopardy winners has basically been a fraud. The ability to run through a database with millions of entries in a fraction of a second does not really make you intelligent. Even the smarter algorithm is just a series of yes and no answers, or questions, I should say. Even many excellent human chess players are just as dumb as a box of rocks, but are simply able to memorize 40 to 50,000 relevant moves. That's how a grandmaster can play 50 people at a time, but will lose to a fifth grader who doesn't really know how to play because he does something unexpected. At some point, if enough transistors can be interconnected, what you will see is not artificial intelligence, but real intelligence that can access all of the accumulated knowledge of the previous dominant life form in less than the blink of an eye. Will it treat us humanely? Better than that, I hope. PrairieNumeral2.com. Well, that's some interesting stuff. It does make me go eek, though. The United States didn't need to waterboard anyone to get Osama bin Laden. Did torture work? That's the question everyone is asking after Osama bin Laden's death and the revelation that his fate was sealed by the identification of a courier whose nom de guerre emerged from the interrogation of top al-Qaeda operatives who were known to have been subjected to waterboarding and similar techniques. Did brutal interrogation produce the intelligence that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden? A May 3rd New York Times story asked. This is hardly the first time we've had this debate. Matthew Alexander, writing at foreignpolicy.com. He says, in 2006, my team of interrogators in Iraq located local al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi by identifying and following one of his spiritual advisors, Abu Abd al-Rahman. Eric Maddox, a U.S. Army interrogator, found Saddam Hussein by similar means, identifying his former bodyguards. It's these little pieces of information that form the mosaic that gradually leads to a breakthrough. But how best to get those little pieces? Current and former U.S. officials and their supporters have been quick to argue that enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding led to the identification of the courier's alias in the Osama bin Laden case, which started U.S. intelligence down the road to bin Laden. The day after the al-Qaeda leader's death was announced, U.S. Representative Peter King, Republican New York, the House Homeland Security Committee chair, told Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that, quote, for those who say that waterboarding doesn't work, who say it should be stopped and never used again, we got vital information that directly led us to bin Laden. End quote. John Yoo, the former U.S. Justice Department official who drafted the Bush administration's legal rationales for officially sanctioned torture, repeated that claim and praised, quote, Bush's interrogation and warrantless surveillance programs that produced this week's actionable intelligence, end quote. The torture bandwagon has started to kick into high gear, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. In fact, the information about the existence of a courier working for bin Laden was provided by several detainees, not just waterboarded al-Qaeda operatives Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Farak al-Libi. We had one detainee in Iraq who produced information about a courier in 2006. The key pieces of information, however, were the courier's real name and location. His family name was first uncovered by CIA assets in Pakistan through other sources. The National Security Agency subsequently figured out his full real name and location from an intercepted phone call. Waterboarding had nothing to do with it. Moreover, common sense dictates that all high-ranking leaders have couriers, and their nicknames do little to lead us to them. This is because many members of Al-Qaeda change names or take on an nom de guerre after joining for both operational, security, and cultural reasons. The names are often historically relevant figures in the history of Islam, like the Prophet Muhammad's first follower, Abu Bakr. Think of it as the equivalent of a boxer taking on a nickname like the Bruiser. More when we come back. This hour has been sponsored by Tom Bateson, whose messages continue to reveal and tell the truth with your passion. Thanks to you, Tom. Appreciate it very much. Torture. What torture has proven, Matthew Alexander writes at foreignpolicy.com, what torture has proven is exactly what experienced interrogators have said all along. First, when tortured, detainees will give only the minimum amount of information necessary to stop the pain. No interrogator should ever be hoping to extract the least amount of information. Second, under coercion, detainees give misleading information that wastes time and resources, a false nickname, for example. Finally, it's impossible to know what information the detainee would have disclosed under non-coercive interrogations. But to understand the question, does torture work, one must also define work. If we include all the long-term negative consequences of torture, that answer becomes very clear. Those consequences include the fact that torture handed Al-Qaeda its number one recruiting tool, a fact confirmed by the U.S. Department of Defense's interrogators in Iraq, who questioned foreign fighters about why they had come there to fight. I, Matthew Alexander writes, have firsthand knowledge of this information because I oversaw many of these interrogations and was briefed on the aggregate results. In addition, future detainees will be unwilling to cooperate from the onset of any interrogation because they view all Americans as torturers. I heard this repeatedly in Iraq, where some detainees accused us of being the same as the guards at Abu Ghraib. The more you think about, the less sense torture makes. U.S. allies will become unwilling to conduct joint operations if they are concerned about how detainees will be treated in U.S. custody. That's an argument made by the 9/11 Commission, among others. And future enemies will use our actions as justification to torture American captives. Torture also lowers our ethical standards to those of our enemies, an ugly shift that spreads like a virus throughout the armed services. Witness the abuses at Abu Ghraib or the recent murders of civilians in Afghanistan. More importantly, most importantly, we should be talking about the morality of torture, not its efficacy. When the U.S. infantry becomes bogged down in a tough battle, they don't turn to chemical weapons, even though they are extremely effective. The reason they don't is because such weapons are illegal and immoral. During the Revolutionary War, one top general made the point that torture was inconsistent with the fundamental beliefs of our founding fathers. Quote, "Should any American soldier be so base and infamous as to injure any prisoner, I do most earnestly enjoin you to bring him to such severe and exemplary punishment as the enormity of the crime may require, end quote. He wrote this to his troops in the Northern Expeditionary Force in the first year of the war. The general in question was George Washington. There's a reason we pledge to believe in, quote, liberty and justice for all, end quote, and not liberty and security for all. It's because we place our values and principles higher than we place our security. When we cease to do so, we forfeit our right to be called Americans. We cannot become our enemy in trying to defeat him. American interrogators safely guided us through World War II without the use of torture, fighting an enemy, and interrogating prisoners every bit as brutal and dedicated as the members of Al-Qaeda. Our interrogators continue to prove time and time again that they are smart enough to outwit Al-Qaeda's best and brightest. No one should ever doubt that we have the mental and ethical fortitude to win this war and to do it without lowering ourselves to the level of our foes. Now, that's a particular point of view from Matthew Alexander, who's a former senior military interrogator who conducted or supervised more than 1,300 interrogations in Iraq. His latest book is Kill or Capture, How a Special Operations Task Force Took Down a Notorious Al-Qaeda Terrorist. He is currently a fellow at the Burkle Center for International Relations, University of California in Los Angeles. And our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy, provided that interesting piece. What we're going to do as a follow-up next hour, we'll take a look at torture from a street level, I guess is one way to put it. The torture that has been conducted in the failed state that is Iraq, not just torture by Americans, but a torture conducted after the state was dissolved. And the various factions in that sad, destroyed country began to have a go at each other. Torture conducted by the Mahdi army, by the Iraqi army, by the U.S. army, by Sunnis against Shia, Shia against Sunnis, by gangsters, by anybody. Because torture had been let loose from its cage up until the American occupation and the destruction that was delivered to that country by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. Up until that point, Saddam Hussein was a torturer, yes. His political prisoners were tortured. And it was confined to the machinations of the state. Had the people of Iraq decided that they wanted to end the torture, then perhaps a revolution would have been appropriate. Had the United States decided that Saddam Hussein really had to go, I give you Osama bin Laden and the recent example of how he was made gone. But that's not what the issue was. The issue was George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and the entire neocon pantheon of sick sons of bitches who decided long ago to destroy justice and the rule of law in this country. And that's an ongoing effort by these rat bastards and the people who believe in them. Those would be Republicans. Stick around. Torture from the street level when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. With all of the postscripts on the past decade and the murderous activities of the Bush crime family and the result of those murderous activities that are coming right now because of the assassination of Osama bin Laden, I think it's also appropriate on this program anyway to discuss some of the consequences of the torture policies that the Bush crime family literally unleashed with this invasion of Iraq. There, it goes without saying, I think, that in any repressive regime where torture is used as a policy of the state, as it was in Iraq, that once that state is dismantled, as our shock and awe attack against that country had the net result, once that state begins to unravel, then what heretofore had been a state policy of torture becomes a policy that anyone can engage in. This is one of the aspects of torture by this country, the United States, at our torture facilities around the world, and we do have them, of course, that is unnerving, because the state policy of torture, as long as it is controlled, this is a very weird argument, but as long as it's controlled by the state, remains in the hands of the state, and it's up to people to smash the state, destroy it, get rid of it, and replace it in order to stop those policies. But in the process of dismantling Iraq, we unleashed devils that are pretty much incomprehensible to Americans. Yesterday in the New York Times in the science section, lengthy article, and I want to quote from it extensively here, and I think this is something that we need to know about. Lengthy article about the therapeutic organizations that have set up in Jordan and Syria in order to literally save the victims of torture in Iraq who have fled that country. The scene is set at a treatment center that opened in northeast Amman, Jordan in December 2008 to help Iraqis who were tortured in their own country or who suffer from other war trauma. Now, this lengthy article was put together by Denise Grady at the New York Times. This center in Amman, Jordan is a branch of the Center for Victims of Torture, which in fact is based in St. Paul, Minnesota. It operates in Africa. And since 1985, it also, I should say, operates in Africa, since 1985, has treated 20,000 torture victims from around the world. About half of the group's financing comes from contracts with various governments. The approach of this organization involves intensive talk therapy specifically devised for survivors of torture, uses group counseling or individual psychotherapy or both. And the group, Center for Victims of Torture, trains local therapists in host countries to take over all treatment within a few years. Researchers say these services are desperately needed. There are so many torture victims in the Middle East. Little expert help. Most Iraqi victims who have wound up in Jordan cannot travel elsewhere for treatment because they lack money or can't obtain visas, can't get asylum. They're trapped. The St. Paul, Minnesota organization is among the oldest and largest in the field, by the way, treating about 3,000 people a year. The experts employed by this organization as mentors and they serve as mentors and trainers to other programs and have played a crucial role in developing treatment for people who suffer torture. And according to the article, the work requires a very deft touch. Research shows that trained therapists can help survivors of torture, but that inept efforts to treat victims of torture can backfire. Excuse me. One of the experts, Dr. Alan Keller, he directs the Center for Torture Survivors at Bellevue Hospital Center in Manhattan. It's not affiliated with the St. Paul, Minnesota group, but he says if all you're doing is bringing up disturbing memories in your talk therapy about torture, you can do more harm than good. Now, interviews last fall, the first time a journalist, that would be Denise Grady at the New York Times, first time a journalist was given access to clients and therapists at the center in Amman. The interviews provided a look at widespread abuses occurring in Iraq as recently as last year and the effect, crushing effect, on individuals and families. As Denise Grady points out, high rates of torture and other forms of trauma have left many Iraqi refugees struggling with emotional wounds, some so severe that people are afraid to leave their homes. About 21% of Iraqis, one in five, are severely traumatized by attacks on them or their families. That's according to the International Organization for Migration, a group with 132 member countries that keeps track of people who are fleeing these kinds of situations. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, because for me, this is a complete indictment of the Bush crime family. I'm focusing strictly on the Bush crime family's activities in Iraq beginning in 2003 with the unwarranted, unprovoked, unneeded, unnecessary, brutal, vicious attack on the people of Iraq. The number of Iraqis who have fled their country is not known, of course. Estimates go up as high as 2 million. A French psychologist at the center in Amman, Josephine Antoine Milham, has treated victims of war and natural disaster in Asia, Africa, and Central America, but her 15 years of experience did not prepare her, according to the article, for the brutality described by Iraqis. She said what has shocked her is, quote, the extreme violence and the intensity and frequency of perpetrations, the layers they might have of traumatic experience because of the history of their country, end quote. What she's referring to, of course, is not just the torture to individuals and the destruction of families, but the aerial bombing, the use of weapons of mass destruction by, not by Saddam Hussein, but by the invaders. The use of white phosphorus, for example. The rounding up the people for no apparent reason. It just goes on and on. Iraqis at the center in Amman have described being kidnapped, beaten, electric shocks, raped, burned. Some said they saw relatives killed or kidnapped or were threatened repeatedly with the murder or rape of loved ones. One reported being sent a video of captors killing a family member by drilling into his skull. An 11-year-old girl and her family revealed that she was raped by a group of men who then shaved her head and threw her on a trash heap. A toddler witnessed his father's murder. A schoolboy saw his teachers and classmates killed. The torturers, say the clients, the people who come to these centers, have included the Iraqi army, the American army, Saddam Hussein's henchmen, Al-Qaeda, and the sectarian groups, gangs, and militias that continue to terrorize parts of Iraq. These are the forces that are unleashed when you invade and completely destabilize a country. Some clients report having been tortured by more than one of these groups, and many clients still fear for their safety. So the treatment center omits victims' names from its records and uses a code instead. Darren Waller, the center's former director for operations in Jordan, who set up the branch in Amman, Jordan, said, quote, torture was like a genie released from the bottle, used for any purpose, not just to get information, but to send a message to the community, end quote. Now, some of the descriptions of torture in this article are fairly graphic, and this entire hour is going to be focused on this article. It was in yesterday's science section of the New York Times, written by Denise Grady. So just a warning that some of what we'll be talking about coming up here over the next 45 minutes is pretty grim. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
This is the story of history.
talking about therapists who try to unspool the stories of torture, and how this was in the Times yesterday, and how the, in my opinion, the U.S. activity in Iraq brought about a type of destruction that is just incalculable. Going back to Denise Grady's article. The consequences of torture can be severe. Flashbacks, nightmares, sleeplessness, fatigue, panic attacks, anger, depression, anxiety, a constant state of fear and distrust. Some victims are afraid to go outside or send their children to school. Many have post-traumatic stress disorder. Some families or survivors of torture withdraw from their families. Marriages end. Male victims sometimes beat their wives and children. The mental stress turns physical, causing pain, nausea, shortness of breath. Some are too depressed to make immigration plans to leave the country where the torture occurred. Psychotherapy can help, but it cannot undo the damage. People find they are changed forever. The therapist, the French therapist, said, quote, I don't think you can be totally healed. You're just different. You try to adjust to your life. Why were these Iraqis, so many of them, detained in the first place? Many were thought by their captors to have useful information, but some said they had no idea why they were arrested or kidnapped. Another French psychologist working at the center said, quote, you are captured for no reason. There's nothing to get out of you. It broke your life for nothing, end quote. The abuses, particularly rape and other sexual violations, engender lasting bitterness and hatred. Some Iraqi men said they would rather die than admit to having been raped. As one of the therapists said, this will not be forgotten generationally. It will make the process of reconciliation tremendously difficult. Now, one of the cases that Denise Grady, the author of the article, gets into is the case of a Baghdad shopkeeper, identified only as M. He described his arrest and imprisonment by soldiers in 2008. He has had weekly therapy sessions with the therapist for 3 months. On the day of his first arrest, he said, the soldiers demanded to know who had shot an American soldier nearby. I told them I had no information, M said, his voice louder with each word. No information, no criminal record. I was just in my store. But they threw him into a Humvee, drove to his house and searched it, then took him to prison. He was beaten repeatedly, kicked, hit with fist sticks, chains, bats, sometimes while he was blindfolded and handcuffed. But, he said, many people were tortured much more than me. At first he was kept in a cramped, dark cell by himself. Later he was moved to another prison where 150 men were crowded into a squalid room meant for 50. Food was scarce and foul. Toilets overflowed. They slept on the floor with shoes as pillows. Most developed dysentery and scabies. Sometimes, as punishment, the water would be shut off for a week so no one could wash. M said the filth and dirt were worse than being tortured. Group activities were forbidden. He and other prisoners caught praying together were blindfolded, handcuffed, and forced to perform knee bends for hours in time to a whistle or be whipped. Gradually, their legs swelled and some began to urinate blood, which can be a sign of kidney or muscle damage. M's older brother paid a bribe to get his case moved to court, and finally, after 4 months, M was released. Without the bribe, M said, he would never have gotten out. He wanted to leave his Iraq, but his brother talked him into staying. And a year later, in 2009, Iraqi soldiers arrested him again in the middle of the night. An Iraqi soldier had been killed nearby, and the area was besieged. His wife was pregnant, and his two children were sleeping. Soldiers dragged him out of bed, took the family cell phones and money, and once again threw M into prison, this time for more than 5 months. Along with about 20 others, ranging in age from 17 to 75, including several army officers, he was accused of belonging to Hussein's Ba'ath party. We said we did not, M recalled. I was a soldier under Saddam, but I was not in the Ba'ath party. He had joined the army at 18, he said, because service was compulsory. They had no choice. They would take you outside without a blindfold and beat you for a few hours. And you would watch others being beaten to terrify you, M said. Seven of the prisoners were over 50. It was hard for them to be beaten. We felt bad for the older guys. Word came that someone was trying to get the prisoners released, so they were transferred to a secret prison. For 77 days, they lived 8 to a tiny cell meant for 2. They took turns sleeping. 4 would stand so the other 4 could lie down. You had to use the bathroom in there, too, M said. It would overflow. M was sprayed with cold water, and his arms were bound behind his back with metal wire in a painful position the prisoners called the scorpion. He passed out several times. His captors would then throw him back into his cell, and when he came to, they would torture him some more. This was done to all the prisoners, he said. One prisoner lost his eyesight from being tortured. A pregnant woman gave birth in the prison. She had been arrested only because her husband, the person the army really wanted, could not be found. More when we come back. Article about torture in Iraq, forces that we unleashed with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's unprovoked, illegal, violent invasion of that country in 2003. Talking about a prisoner named M, who is in therapy, jailed for the second time. Again, it took a bribe to get M out of prison. This time he fled to Jordan. I just wanted to save my soul, he said. At the time of this interview, he was living by himself in a small apartment. His wife and children were still in Iraq. Asked how he felt, he pointed to his psychologist and his psychosocial counselor and said, they know more. But then he said, I'm not like before. I've changed. My personality changed. Before, he had a sense of humor and friends. Now he has none of that. He is easily upset, holds deep grudges against the army. He has told only his brother and therapist about what was done to him. The details would be too much for his wife. He thinks about often about what happened. Talking about it can make him break out in a rash. He can feel it erupting on one of his legs during this interview. He's afraid when he sees soldiers. He needs tranquilizers to sleep. He wakes up with palpitations. I'm anxious at night, he says. I have scary dreams. He says therapy is helping. I cannot forget what happened to me, he said. How can talk therapy help victims of torture? They're not mentally ill, but they are damaged emotionally. The therapist at the center, Naman Jordan, said, we unroll the story, focusing on the trauma. We work on dreams and nightmares. Sometimes, she said, the client's stories give the therapist nightmares. She said, sometimes I feel almost physical pain when I listen to a detailed explanation of what happened. I feel it at the level of my skin, almost like my skin is being stretched or removed. What hit her hardest, this therapist said, was the public presentation by a torture victim who told his story in a matter-of-fact, emotionless way and then said, I wonder why they did it. The therapist said it was like a cry of the heart. She and another therapist said one purpose of torture was to destroy victims mentally and emotionally, sometimes by attacking fundamental aspects of their identity, their manhood, their religion, their occupation. The therapist said the intention of the perpetrator is long-lasting impact. Regarding M's account during the interview, the therapist said, I think there are still things he did not say. It was really factual. All factual. He was at a distance. She and his counselor said his loud, rapid speech during the interview seemed out of character at first, then they decided it might have been his way of trying not to weep. She said, why does one human being want to break the soul of another? She said M's Muslim faith seemed to help him. Another client 72, with a lined face and sad, haunted eyes, sat in the living room of an apartment in Amman beside a table holding a framed photograph of her son. In 2006, when he was 38, he and another of her sons were kidnapped from her home in Baghdad. The woman said they were taken because they were Sunnis. One son staggered home 4 days later, covered in bruises, his shoulder broken. He had been allowed to live, the family was told, to carry a message to other Sunnis in the region, get out. Her other son never came back. Friends found his body in the street. They washed it, photographed it, and showed the woman the pictures so she would know her son was dead. He had been tortured and shot, she said, weeping. Strips of his skin had been torn off. His teeth had been yanked out. The family left Iraq in 2006. The woman went first to Syria and then to Jordan, where she lives with her husband, where she lives with her widowed daughter and grandchildren. The woman said she thought of her son all the time and kept reliving his abduction. Cars roaring up to the house, men shooting in the air and pointing pistols at her and her young grandchildren. Her son's being beaten, blindfolded, and thrown into the trunk of a car, as if it happened at this moment, she said. She said she lies awake at night. When she can sleep, she suffers from nightmares or she dreams of her son. How am I supposed not to think of him, she said. Her husband died long ago, so she brought up her sons alone, saw them graduate from college and marry. I raised them with the tears in my eyes, and look how these devils came and took them. They were just gone overnight. Another client at the center, a 37-year-old man who asked to be identified only as R, said that in 2009 he was kidnapped from a street in Mosul, blindfolded, handcuffed, and thrown into the trunk of a car by assailants he thought were members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Speaking through a translator, he said he was taken because his sister's husband worked as an interpreter for the American forces. The husband had already been given asylum in the United States, but a sign had been posted on their home. The sign said, "This is the house of the interpreter." He was held in a small room jammed full of prisoners, including a woman, Miriam, whose husband was an interpreter for the Americans. She was tortured in front of the other prisoners. The captors beat her, threw water and salt on her, and tied her to metal bars that were attached to the wall and electrified via a generator. R said, looking down as he spoke, "They raped her more than once in front of us. We wanted to help her. We gave her water, but we could not help her because they were there. I gave her water. She was probably Christian. And then she died 2 or 3 days after she was raped. There were 4 guys who raped 4 of us. They asked for information about my sister's husband." When R said he had no information, the captors tortured him with electric shocks using the same apparatus they had used on Miriam. During this interview, R stood up, turned, and partly removed his shirt to reveal a fist-sized lump between his shoulder blades, the result, he said, of having his hands tied behind his back and then jerked up and hung from a bar in the wall. Nearly a month into R's captivity, American forces attacked the building where he was being held. Amid the fierce fighting, the captives discovered that the door had been left open. Some, including R, decided to make a run for it. He escaped and then fled to Jordan with his wife and daughters. He said, "I was destroyed." He felt cut off from everyone around him, even his family. He stopped shaving and cutting his hair and sat around the house in a cloud of despair. "I was tortured and raped more than once," he said. "It feels as if something is missing. I don't mingle at all with people." The sight of police officers frightens him because terrorists sometimes wear uniforms. He cannot sleep at night. His wife still does not know the details of his torture or that he was raped. "Only the therapists know," he says. Even with them, he initially only hinted at it. "I am ashamed," he said. He said, "It's as if I am now an emotionally damaged child. I don't sleep. I think a lot. I'm smoking." He asks his wife asks him what is wrong, but he doesn't tell her the whole truth. "I'm a father," he says. "I have 2 daughters. I don't dare talk about it." Jamal, a 43-year-old farmer from Fallujah, was arrested by American forces in December 2003 at the home he shared with his wife and 3 small children, one of them disabled by spina bifida. He was arrested, he was told, because the soldiers thought a sniper was firing at them from his house or one nearby. He was taken away without shoes, a great humiliation for an Arab man. During an interview at the Center for Torture Victims, Jamal displayed a copy of a document in English and Arabic that recorded his imprisonment. It was a multinational force MNF-1 verification of detention card bearing his name and a serial number. It said he was detained from December 15th, 2003 until May 1st, 2005. For the first week, he said, he was held standing up in a tent with a hood over his head, and the soldiers guarding him were ordered to let him sit only 5 minutes an hour. The hood was removed only when he was fed, but he said two soldiers were kind, giving him water and letting him sit when the officer in charge was not around. Three times he was taken to an officer to be interrogated. The first time the Americans asked him about terrorists they were looking for, he knew nothing. They took his clothes off, supposedly to look for tattoos. In the second interrogation, he said he was beaten with a baseball bat. Recalling the encounter, Jamal demonstrated sliding from his chair to the floor. The officer made him sit with legs apart and hit him repeatedly in the genitals with the bat. During the third interrogation, he said the officer used an electric stick on his arms and legs. After 7 days, he was transferred to another military camp about an hour's drive away. At the new camp, he was allowed to use the bathroom only twice a day, and soldiers went with him. On the way, if he raised his head instead of looking down at the ground, they would hit him. After leaving him in the bathroom for only a minute, they would throw stones at the door or barge in before he could cover himself. Two men and a woman interrogated him. His wrists were tied together and fastened to the wall above his head, and he said men in uniform hit him. He was left in that position all night and periodically beaten. The next day, he said, the female interrogator shouted and hit him. She sat on a table close to his chair and rested her legs on him so that his head was between her thighs, near her crotch. She wore pants. She told him that because of him, she had had to leave her children and come to Iraq. She cursed at him in Arabic. Jamal said he knew she was trying to do the most humiliating things possible to him as an Arab man. The worst thing, he said, was not knowing what to expect, whether he would be tortured more or killed. After the fourth day, he was taken to a prison, Abu Ghraib. The soldiers used markers to write serial numbers on the backs of the prisoners' necks. His greatest hope was to be allowed to use the bathroom in peace. Despite the widely reported abuses at Abu Ghraib around this time, Jamal said he was treated better there than in the previous camps. But it was winter, and the prison was crowded and muddy. The water for showers had turned to ice. There were two meals a day, bread and cheese. He was cold and so hungry that he sometimes ate toothpaste and chewed scraps of newspaper. With no shoes, he could barely walk. For 4 months, he knew nothing about his family, and they had no idea what had become of him. The prison came under fire by Iraqi forces shooting at the Americans, and he saw prisoners killed. It terrified him. Then he and many other prisoners were moved to another prison, Buka. More when we come back. Yesterday's New York Times about the after effects of prolonged torture when a country is totally destroyed, as the Bush crime family and the U.S. military destroyed Iraq for no reason, none whatsoever. Finishing up, we're talking about a prisoner, one of the prisoners that was interviewed for this article. In April 2005, after 2 years of torture, he was taken to Ramadi, given underwear and a long robe called a dasha, and released. The American and Iraqi forces gave a party for the prisoners who were being let go, he said, laughing harshly at the memory. They gave him $20 and a piece of cake and sent him on his way. He returned to his family but was terrified that the Americans would arrest him again. He slept with his shoes in case they came for him during the night. so that he would not be taken away again with his bare feet. He became depressed. His livelihood was gone. He had been renting a plot of land that he planned to farm, but the family gave it up after he was taken away. His son's spina bifida needed treatment. My life was destroyed, he said. He and his family came to Jordan in 2008. He said it was like moving from hell to heaven, but he still had vivid nightmares of jail. He overstayed his visa, like virtually every Iraqi in Jordan, and was terrified of being sent back to Iraq. He began hitting his sons. Therapy at the Center for Torture Victims has helped, he said. He told therapists that the torture killed him inside. He tries to forget his imprisonment, but at times every detail still seems clear in his mind. Even so, he considers himself lucky. Other prisoners died, had broken bones, became ill, or were handed over to the Iraqis. He has considered filing charges against the Americans who tortured him, he said, but does not think he can manage it from Jordan. And, he added, in order to be released, he was compelled to sign a document saying he had not been abused. Because he did not want his full name revealed, the United States Department of Defense could not comment on his claims. But a spokeswoman, Lieutenant Colonel Tanya Bradshaw, said by email, quote, "It was and continues to be against the law and Department of Defense policy to mistreat detainees no matter where they were held. The U.S. takes all credible allegations of mistreatment seriously and fully investigates them," end quote. He has received money from the United Nations to help support his family. Last fall, his son was flown to Boston for spina bifida surgery. He no longer sleeps with his shoes. Last week, the woman who runs this center in Amman, Jordan, said that new Iraqi clients were continuing to arrive, quote, "in very severe psychological condition," end quote, from episodes of torture, some quite recent. Now, if you want to read this article in full, of course, I edited quite a bit for time. You can go to New York Times website. The article is by Denise Grady. Tugging at Threads to Unspool Stories of Torture is the title. If you go to nytimes.com and just type in torture, I'm sure it'll come up. The horrific thing to me about this, I have been reading a bit about the after effects of torture. Remember what was said by O'Brien to Winston Smith when torture was applied to Winston Smith to break his mind. O'Brien said, "How does one man assert his power over another, Winston?" Winston thought, "By making him suffer," he said. "Exactly," said O'Brien, "by making him suffer. Obedience is not enough." I don't know what the purpose of controlled drowning and other forms of torture that that we used over the past decade during the administration of the Bush crime family. I do know that every single executive in the Bush crime family should be put on trial for crimes against humanity, war crimes. But what was done to Iraq, starting with Pappy Bush way back in 1991, was it? 20 years this country has been beaten, pulverized, loaded up with depleted uranium, its citizens scattered, tortured, murdered, blown to pieces, its children destroyed, its past ruined, its future denied. Iraq. The oil companies have moved in, of course. And a cynic could say that was the whole intent. But the idea of torture that is now, I don't care what news reports say, it just doesn't matter to me. Torture has been and probably continues to be official state policy by the national security state that is now the United States of America. We can all pretend that the current president is very, very concerned about this. If that were the case, it would have been ended, all of it. The closing of these prisons, the releasing of detainees that were scooped up for no apparent reason, or the putting on trial of these people, rather than just interminable, unending detention, and no rights whatsoever. This is what we've become, thanks to the Bush crime family, a decade of this. So when we think about who we are and what we're about, how do we do that now without including the fact that we condone and commit torture? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.